Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. The tension between faith and reason continues in the West more than 400 years after René Descartes fueled the Enlightenment with his declaration, "I think, therefore I am." Our guest journalist, Russell Shorto, bridges the divide. Mr. Shorto plays detective in his book Descartes' Bones, following Descartes' earthly remains and his ideas through the centuries. Mr. Shorto suggests we underestimate how powerfully the West has been affected by all the new ways of thinking which have emerged since Descartes' time.
I would postulate that a society that has gone through the centuries of Descartes' Bones, a society that has experienced the Enlightenment, experienced the flaws of it, of thinking that reason alone can solve problems, is one that is on the verge of being able to access these traditions. Whereas a society that has not done that may not be there.
Russell Shorto followed the success of his best-selling book, The Island at the Center of the World, with Descartes' Bones, a skeletal history of the conflict between faith and reason. He's also a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine and director of the John Adams Institute in Amsterdam, where he lives. Bill Russell and I share Mr. Shorto's interest in and commitment to new ways of thinking about faith and reason. So we were intensely interested in revisiting what we thought we knew about Descartes and the Enlightenment as we began this conversation. Russell Shorto, you have me thinking about my friends, the Neanderthals.
Okay.
We were doing a program many years ago with Ian Tattersall, who said, "Now look, Paula, you cannot possibly even begin to think about what it would be to be a Neanderthal." Mm-hmm. It's just totally, I mean, there's just no way. I sort of had that feeling reading Descartes' Bones that it would be almost as hard to think about living at the time of Descartes, mm-hmm, and living in that moment as to be in the moment of a Neanderthal.
That's a very good comparison, I think, because the big challenge is at that moment, which was really on the other side of the modern era.
Before.
Well, it was right on the cusp, but for most people, it was very much on the other side. To try to comprehend that, first of all, to try to comprehend the way anyone today, living today in a society that didn't experience the Enlightenment, the way they perceive the world is a huge challenge. And separate yourself three or four centuries in time, and it's an enormous difficulty. And by the same token, you suffer this same problem when you're doing biography. I mean, writing about anyone, any other person. I mean, you pick up three biographies of Ronald Reagan, and you're going to get radically different pictures of, it would seem to be three different people. That's someone who existed in our lifetime. And you try to write about someone removed three or four centuries, and it's a challenge. It's humbling.
It's humbling. Well, and you didn't pick just any old body.
Right. But I will say also that I wasn't doing a biography. If it's a biography, it's a post-mortem biography. So it's not so much a biography of the man, but of his remains, both literal and metaphorical.
Well, my sense is that you found a wonderful tool for putting us in context. That is to say, the people we are today, mm-hmm, how did we end up in this? We tend to take it for granted. We tend to take the modern, as you call it, and now the postmodern, for granted, and sort of assume that that's the way it's always been. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's not the case. And this goes a long way. And for all, Descartes has been around a long time, mm-hmm, and we all have read about mind-body duality, mm-hmm, and all the things that go with that. Your cut across it, to me, was an interesting variation, or an important variation.
Well, I just read a review of my book, which approached it as though I were writing it in order to take Descartes and elevate him, or re-elevate him onto some sort of pedestal. And frankly, that wasn't
not your job.
That wasn't my job. That wasn't what I was after.
It's not your book either.
No, it's not. What I was trying to do was, and I think it, this occurred to me a day or two ago, that I first came across this odd fact that 16 years after Descartes died, his remains were dug up and people began to take pieces of him. I first encountered that in 2003, which was not long after September 11th, 2001. And from that moment began this reappraisal of the modern, of Western secular culture, you know, as though people were saying, okay, this thing is under attack. Well, what is this thing anyway? What is this world that we live in? What is it that it's our framework that we take for granted? And that, as you were starting to suggest, the decades of postmodernism was kind of pushing it into the background, and suddenly people are saying, no, let's revisit the Enlightenment. What are these values of ours?
I've been saying for years that the Enlightenment didn't take. That if you, particularly in this country, and in many ways you help clarify that, because there are a lot of people still today in this country, particularly in this country, who are out of that trinity that you create, are still in the essentially in the backward looking, the historical, the classical mindset.
Well, what do you mean by backward? Historical.
Oh, let's do that when we come back in just a moment, because okay. I can see okay. a real discussion happening okay. here. We are with Russell Shorto. He has written Descartes' Bones, the subtitle of which is also important, A Skeletal History, nice little triple entendre there,
thank you.
Of the conflict between faith and reason. Much more to be said. Stay with us. Russell Shorto, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. We're talking about Descartes. We're talking about, which could sound like way back when, but we're also talking about right now.
I can clarify that. I think I can. It is the scholastic model, the view that faith and belief, and particularly your religion, is defining. And there are still a lot of people in this country. We're in the middle of a political campaign, you've probably noticed.
As we speak.
And that is a solid piece of what the discussion inevitably revolves around.
Yeah.
And what you've done is to make sense of the condition in which this country finds itself. Partly that group, and but also that moderate group of Enlightenment thinkers.
That trilogy is. If
that
you
seemed
would.
To, mm-hmm. He's qualified. I'm
Mr.
not.
Mr. Shorto.
Okay. You bring up the election, and I think that one reason that people are so interested in this election is that the years of the Bush era have coincided with a rise of fundamentalisms, Muslim fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism, and I would say secular atheist fundamentalism, which
and Hindu fundamentalism,
neocon fundamentalism.
But, economic fundamentalism.
But all of which, of course, set themselves up as the right as opposed to the wrong. There's always a dichotomy, a black-white way of looking at things. And one reason I wrote the book was to explore the modern centuries for myself. And as I started to say before, after 9/11, doing my own quest for, you know, I studied philosophy at university, and you know, you have a sort of humanities background, and you... and to go back and revisit and say, you know, sound these things out for myself. And I found in the actual physical bones of Descartes and the way they were handled and the people who handled them, a nice metaphor for that. And a nice, you know, I don't like to take a standard path. I'm not going to do, you know, the modern era 101. It's going to be something.
Descartes was born in.
Exactly. Although you got to, there's some of that you have to.
There was the man who died. But, he did that
right,
for us.
Right. But your point that, so now we're in this era of competing fundamentalisms, which you could say started with that generation where you had this theological worldview, and suddenly it had something opposed to it. You could say a worldview based on reason. But very quickly, what developed was not a two-way, but a sort of three-way split. Joining those was a kind of moderate enlightenment, and here I'm using the categories of Jonathan Israel, who said that you had a radical enlightenment in which the modern thinkers really oppose themselves violently to the old religious perspective. But you also had a moderate enlightenment, which said part of the job of reason is to figure out how to incorporate the irrational within the human sphere, because that is, in fact, part of what we are, whether it's art or faith or what have you. And so over the course of the modern centuries, you see these three forces at play. And the more fundamentalist ones will tend to try to say, no, it's just the two of us and it's a fight to the death. But there is this other as well. And I would say that these years of the Bush era has we've seen such a rise of fundamentalists that you see a lot, that I think a lot of people are yearning for something, for some leader to come forward and say there's another way to do this.
Well, and just historically, this was manifested in the French Revolution and the American Revolution, which are very radically different notions of what a revolution is.
Precisely.
And again, this the distinction between the moderate Enlightenment uh-huh. and the radical Enlightenment matches, certainly by your telling, and it seems to be, from what I know, a legitimate description, that tracks fairly closely with the nature of those revolutions.
Exactly.
And how are they different?
Where the French Revolution was, they're both true revolutions. The French Revolution was a revolution against the state and also against the church. And if you look back 150 years more to the time of Descartes, what the seeds that were planted then, the revolutionaries during the French Revolution saw themselves as the fruits of that. And they saw that what started then with this concentration of understanding on the individual, on, as Descartes said, the mind and its good sense, what it had developed into by the 1780s and 1790s was this awareness, that this conviction that absolute government was wrong, and government based on individual rights is what ought to replace it, and that that the church as having autocratic power was wrong and had to be destroyed. So the French Revolution was they went around destroying churches, murdering priests, and the perfect comparison or contrast is imagine George Washington and his armies roaming up and down the East Coast destroying churches. I mean, it didn't happen because it was just assumed as part of the inheritance of the American Revolution that religion was going to be part of the fabric of society.
You talk about that also in terms of the newness and the oldness. You talk about France having the most autocratic system mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. all of Europe, mm-hmm. both in terms of the grasp that both the state and the church had, mm-hmm. and in what would become the United States, neither of those had the same kind of power for lots of reasons, including geography and being a long mm-hmm. way from the mm-hmm. motherland.
Yeah.
So the once again, context really matters
yeah.
here.
Yeah. Then the blank slate of America was,
of course, you were a native.
Well, blank slate in the sense that, the European culture developing in a place where they didn't have the constraints, they didn't have, guilds extending into the Middle Ages and so on, allowed it to develop in a very different
way. That's quite Darwinian in a kind of interesting way, isn't it?
It is, but that's one element. It's one template, one way of interpreting the difference.
It also, this country started thinking of itself as a nation in the context of the Enlightenment, mm-hmm. which is a radically different Genesis origin myth than certainly any of the nations of Europe, and really most of the nations around the world. Mm-hmm. There's this window in time when the full force of the moderate Enlightenment, particularly mm-hmm. the English Enlightenment, mm-hmm. was trendy.
Yeah.
and the thinkers, the people that were designing this country, thinking about what kind of government we should have that would be different from and resolve some of the problems that we had inherited from Great Britain, were working in the context of the Enlightenment.
And that, I was going to say, another template, another way of looking at that difference between France and the U.S., for example, is the American is obviously in the British model and the French in the continental, and the French were known and are known still for their sort of top-down approach and their mm-hmm. abstract thinking, and the British, the British approach to the Enlightenment was a kind of tinkerer's approach, like little men in their workshops with the practical, let's solve this puzzle, let's figure out, a new approach to this kind of gear, whereas the French, they had the Academy of Sciences, and they wanted to divide knowledge into different categories, and, both are useful, but I think the British, a lot of the British spirit applied in the American context as well.
We have sort of just assumed everybody knows what the modern is.
We would assume that people know who Descartes is, so they are.
So let's step back a little bit. In this context, how would you characterize the modern era?
Can I do it with Descartes?
Absolutely.
Sure.
Okay. Descartes, if I do the traditional, Descartes was born in 1596.
Yeah, but
it's okay. The context matters.
Born in 1596, died in 1650, and that lifespan neatly coincides with this period in Europe in which there was this exuberant outburst of exploration of the natural world with grinding lenses and looking in microscopes and telescopes and dissecting corpses, and all of which was at odds with the system of knowledge that had been built up over the previous 1,000 years, which was a blend of, which was mostly Christian teaching, but blended with ideas from Aristotle and other thinkers, and which did its job. It explained a lot of things for people for a long period of time, but in light of this work that was going on, it didn't explain it very well. And at the same time, the work that William Harvey was doing and that Francis Bacon was doing and Galileo didn't have a new a foundation. So what Descartes did, in essence, was provide a foundation, provide a new intellectual foundation for this. And in a phrase, I think, therefore I am, cogito ergo sum. In the phrase that, you know, he famously sits down. The great thing about, one of the very nice things about Descartes as a philosopher is that he was modern in his prose style as well. He often wrote in the first person. It's quite readable.
He wrote in French.
He wrote in French, not in Latin. And he describes in the I think therefore I am exercise. He describes himself sitting in his dressing gown before the fire, and so he sort of welcomes you into the story, and then explains that the knowledge that he had been taught he just doesn't trust, and so he's going to perform a little exercise. What he's going to do is take each piece of received wisdom and examine it. If it doesn't seem sound, he's going to set it aside. And he describes this as a test because some of these pieces of received wisdom are things like the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ, which, you know, if he's, you know, comes out and says this is not...
That's a little dicey.
Yeah, yeah. So this is only a test. So he goes one by one through things and sets everything aside until he comes to one thing that he can't doubt, and that is the fact that he's thinking these thoughts. I think, therefore, there must be this thing that exists that is thinking these thoughts, which is the human mind, and then that, he decides, is the basis on which to build a new kind of knowledge, and that's the beginning of the modern.
And this we will return in just a moment to see why that is just downright revolutionary with Russell Shorto, the Russell I. Paula Gordon, Mr. Shorto. All three of us invite you to be with us when we return. A skeletal history of the conflict between faith and reason, Descartes' Bones, which Russell Shorto has written. Bill?
This also occurs in the context after the Reformation, but after a long series of really nasty wars.
Mm-hmm. Big time.
In Europe, and you
fundamentally religious wars.
Mm-hmm. Profoundly religious wars between the established church, the Catholic Church, and all the various forms of Protestantism. And that backdrop is not irrelevant in this.
Not at all.
And I would think that part of it is the incredible damage and destruction which was consequent to these disagreeing faiths.
Mm-hmm.
And that probably a lot of people were looking for something that would provide a basis for knowledge, but more substantially a basis for action.
Mm-hmm.
That would prevent this kind of thing happening again.
Yeah, I think it works that way. It also works the other way, which is to say the Catholic Church had taken a lot of hits in the form of the Reformation, and now here comes another threat in the form of, I mean, you know, what we would call science was not given that name at the time, and it was being perceived as a threat or as a weapon, which could be, you know, there was, and the Church, and for that matter, autocratic states, monarchical states were attracted by this new thing because it might be useful to them, but at the same time, they perceived that something in it was dangerous to them. So it worked. It worked in that context as well.
And
but what you say about the religious wars, the 30 Years' War and the 80 Years' War, they ended. It's you know, and I would have to think more about how the ending of those wars in 1648. I mean, that by that time you had kind of the end of the first era of the modern thinkers of Francis Bacon and Descartes and Galileo. So that all kind of came to a head at the same period of time, but Descartes himself was, I think, kind of stridently not a political thinker in the sense of, you know, war frames my perspective and I will now, you know, respond to it.
Well, he's not Machiavelli.
No, not at all. He wasn't trying to be.
He's also a devout Catholic. I mean, he was probably overly insistent on that for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm.
Well, it was good for his health, for one.
That, okay, well, to that point, he was a devout Catholic. It's an interesting point because there are three or four top Descartes scholars in the world today who are divided on that question. Hmm. Richard Watson, who's the premier American Descartes scholar, and they all helped me with my book, read the manuscript, or I asked them these kinds of questions. And Richard Watson thinks that, in fact, Descartes was just paying lip service to the church, that he didn't believe this stuff, but you just couldn't advance without it. Jean-Robert Armagat, who's the leading French Descartes scholar, who also, by the way, happens to be a Catholic priest.
And used to be the chaplain of Notre Dame.
Yes.
Not just any old priest.
Exactly.
And gave some great barbecues on the deck.
You read all the details of the book. He believes that, in fact, Descartes was a devout Catholic. And I tend to agree with him because I don't. For one thing, I just don't see anything. There's no smoking gun. There's nothing to prove otherwise. But that whole question is itself interesting because here in Descartes is the person most identified with bringing the modern sensibility into being, and yet he himself had this struggle between how to reconcile it with his own faith, which you might say he's a stand-in for all of us, or for everyone who came after.
Excuse me, in that context, you talk about what I just instantly treated as Trinity, which is the mind and the body, mm-hmm. and then God. Mm-hmm. And then you end with a Trinity mm-hmm. that is the mind and the body and the heart, which is, a to me, an interesting in some ways, journey from it reflects Descartes' movement by your accounting, but I think it must also reflect some of what you happened to you as you worked your way through.
I haven't thought of it quite like that, and that's interesting. So I'll have to think about that a bit. I mean, what you say about the one type of Trinity moving into the other.
I'm going to give you a third one after a while.
But, three Trinities.
But certainly Descartes himself said that there is, in fact, a third substance. I mean, that reality dividing into the mind and body, or the mental and the material world. And he said that there is this third substance, which is God, which allows it all to happen. It's the background. It's the but you know, looking at it strictly, you know, that he had to abstract when he's looking at the sort of philosophical puzzle of dualism, which was a dangerous thing in the 17th century because
dualism was dangerous.
Yes, because
ever since the Manichaean heresy, it had been
dangerous.
And
at this time, what was happening was because the church had given itself purview over the whole deal. It explained how the planets moved and so on. As people like Galileo, as science began to come up with quite good explanations for some of that, it diminished the sphere of the church. So one thing that Descartes, partly as a good Catholic, was trying to do was build a wall between the mind and the body, and saying that therefore, you know, as all the prying that scientists want to do, they're only going to be doing it in the physical world. They won't touch this special world of the noumenal. But then what happened was that gets smaller and smaller, and so then people start to feel, well, do we even need that?
And the problem, of course, is having built that wall, somehow you've got to reconnect it, which is where this third item keeps coming back up and coming back up.
So since you bring up the heart as the third item now, this is something I find really interesting in Descartes, because When I studied philosophy, we learned what we studied was Descartes' bogus solution to the mind-body problem, which was the pineal gland. This part of the brain which he identifies as the place where mind and body come together, even though mind and body can't actually interact. Now, as soon as he gives voice to that, people start to ridicule it, because if mind and body truly are distinct and can't interact, how can you have a physical part of the brain that is a place where they interact?
Yeah, but he wasn't stupid about it the way our generalizations about it are.
No, he wasn't. But he himself realized that this didn't work. But what he came to late in his life, in his last book, The Passions of the Soul, is, to me, a very prescient notion. It foreshadowed a lot of what people in the past 30 or 40 years have been working on, and that's this notion that the passions in the 17th century were emotions, and our emotions work on our physical beings and in our mental beings. And so he, while being very humble at this point late in his life and saying, you know, maybe our minds are structured so that we can't figure this out, but here's the best I've come up with. The emotions, heart, are a kind of bridge that wraps itself around mind and body, so that experience of reality is maybe the ultimate human experience of reality.
That which I want to add as a third trinity seems to me some of thinking about the power of ideas. Mm-hmm. When in your philosophy class they talked about the pineal gland and Descartes mm-hmm. blew it because of that. Well, in my philosophy class, which I remember very dimly, he was reduced, and boy, I say reduced as in reductionist, very carefully, into, Descartes dualism, mm-hmm. end of subject. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not the end of the subject, because Descartes is reflecting back to and from and against Aristotle, who also gets this bad rap mm-hmm. of dualism, and it's Aristotle who tells us, don't forget the excluded middle. Mm-hmm. So that's always been there for mm-hmm, us, mm-hmm. if people will slow down enough to say, rather than, I come back to that, thinking about what you both were saying about the fundamentalisms of this moment, all of them, mm-hmm. that it is very easy to get trapped in that Descartes dualism, the what Bill often calls the caricatures,
mm-hmm, exactly.
that just don't serve a planet where we're, you talk about your kids are all over the world and their friends. And, well, some of this is coming to terms with, as you did in 2003, let's look at where we are with these things, and mm-hmm. maybe that excluded middle or the passions mm-hmm. or the emotions mm-hmm. or some of this is you're giving us an opportunity to reach into some new places and honor that out of which we come.
That's what I think. Part of the problem is we're finite beings. We only have so much time. You're taking a philosophy 101 course, and they're going to give you this much time on Descartes, or you know, an American history course, and they're going to give you this much time on Abraham Lincoln, and everything gets reduced. And on the larger scheme of things, though, that kind of it's fine if what you're doing is reducing bits of knowledge within a particular sphere, but
if you come back and expand them again.
Exactly. And I think at different moments in history, and we are in one now, there is a hunger for expanding that.
And we have science friends who work in the sciences who talk about toy models as a way of trying to, they will create a toy model knowing that the model is not complete and does mm-hmm. not represent whatever the physical condition mm-hmm. That they're trying to describe, but just as a means of thinking about of playing with it, of working with it, mm-hmm. with the idea that this model can become richer, more complex. And in some senses, most of the philosophy courses and science, most of the courses we get mm-hmm. are toys in that context.
The problem is
we mistake the toy for the reality.
Exactly.
And it's very confusing. You point out and come back to it several times that there is this deep human craving for certainty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which was part of the appeal of the old view, the pre-modern, and it was part of the appeal of the modern.
Mm-hmm. And it's part
the difference is the source of that certainty.
And of fundamentalism as well. We'll be back in just a moment to explore certainty, and I'm sure we'll have something certain for you when we come back with Russell Short. He'll be with us. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. What a pleasure to be in the company both of René Descartes and Russell Shorto, who talks about Descartes and the time in which he lived with a very clever twist, Descartes' Bones, a skeletal history of the conflict between faith and reason. We went away talking about certainty. That really is a major theme through your book, isn't mm-hmm. it? The search mm-hmm. for, the longing for, the inability ever to find.
which, as Bill said, played out in the pre-modern world in one way, and in the modern world in quite another way. But in both cases, you have humans hungering for certainty and having a different, looking for it with it from a different foundation. And what is interesting to me in the small story of Descartes' Bones is that there are a number of times when a particular relic of Descartes, his skull, comes into the picture, resurfaces. And for example, in the 1820s, the French Academy of Sciences, it's brought to their attention that the remains of Descartes have been sitting ever since the French Revolution in a garden somewhere, and they decide they have to do something about this. They open it up and they discover there's no skull.
Oops.
It just so happens that a Swedish chemist has been visiting them. He returns to Sweden. A couple of years later, he's opening a newspaper in Stockholm, and he sees that somebody has died and his estate is being auctioned, and among the items is the skull of René Descartes. So he rushes to it turns out a casino operator has bought the skull in order to decorate his casino with it, I guess. And he buys it from him and sends it to the savants at the French Academy. And there's this great, image around 1820 when you have all these leading French scientists gathered around this skull, observing it with, appropriate secular reverence, I guess. And then comes the question, how do we know for sure this is Descartes' skull? And so it starts again, this quest for certainty over the object.
This is a very modern, and I think it must be part of why you spent the time writing this book, a modern concern, this notion of certainty, mm-hmm. and all the various ways that we keep trying to reach it, and usually lying to ourselves in the process. I finished your book yesterday morning. Last night I had this sense that it was something I wanted to do, so I sat down and watched The Fog of War. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with The Fog of War?
I'm familiar with it.
It's about McNamara.
Yeah.
And it's about McNamara's role in, particularly with respect to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And McNamara, of course, in his best and brightest, as mm-hmm. Halberstam, and McNamara as well, that's what they called themselves, and it's what mm-hmm. Halberstam wrote about. These were very smart people. They were people who whose logic was impeccable.
Very reasonable people.
Very reasonable mm-hmm. people. And this, The Fog of War, essentially, the subtitle is, 11 rules that McNamara learned about how to run the world.
Too late.
There were three of them that jumped out at me as I sat and watched this and thought about you. Rule number two was rationality will not save us.
Mm-hmm.
Rule number seven is belief and seeing are both often wrong. And again, this plugs in directly mm-hmm. to what you're talking about. And number eight is be prepared to re-examine your reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And I say all this because the consequences of what you're talking about, this is not just an academic exercise. This is not just an intellectual exercise. This is not just an exercise in reading a book. The kinds of things you're talking about have real-world consequences mm-hmm. all day, every day.
Yeah.
And we ignore them at our peril.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree, and that gets back to this notion of, and when you say that, I particularly think of it in terms of the the spate of books in recent years by Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, who are basically saying, apropos of this period in which you have warring religious fundamentalisms, these people are going to annihilate themselves. We have, over the past few centuries, learned a thing or two that is really, truly part of the as Hitchens says, the infancy of our species, and we have to recognize that and move on. When you say, rationality isn't going to do it, right? That alone isn't the answer. I mean, it simply isn't, because for one thing, our ability to employ reason is flawed. And for another, reason is only part of the sphere. It's only part of the human spectrum, part of the spectrum of reality.
Well, and there has been, you know, yes, there we've learned a great deal. One of the things we've learned in that intervening period, of course, is the limits of reason. You've got Gödel's incompleteness theorem that just undercuts this, the whole basic notion. You know, the fundament of reason ultimately gets you to logic. Mm-hmm. And Whitehead and Bertrand Russell formalized, mathematicized logic. So we can, you know, we can track it. The problem, of course, is it doesn't apply to the world we live in exclusively. Mm-hmm. I mean, you simply cannot reach truth via that mechanism with respect even to the internals of logic, which is what Gödel was about. Once you add people into that equation, humans into that equation, with all the things that we come equipped with.
Including those emotions of which you spoke.
Well, the emotion, that's why the heart piece to me is so important. We simply have to incorporate, include other things in our thinking. The heart, as an example.
Yeah, unfortunately we're in agreement, because it would be a more fruitful discussion, I guess.
We can explore agreement.
But
when did you stumble on this heart thing? Because it seems to me that in a way, a back channel to what Bill is saying is when you came upon this little piece of information that you put in the epilogue, that you've told the whole story all over again.
It gives you a whole different wash on the story.
Tell us that story.
First of all, where it comes in Descartes' life is interesting. Descartes he was a vain, irascible, unpleasant loner who had many friends as long as they were devotees of his. And when they argued with him, then they were no longer friends.
He didn't say vindictive, which is also...
And vindictive as well, yeah. And he had one known intimate relationship in his life. When he was staying in Amsterdam with an Englishman, he had a relationship with... with the housekeeper, a woman named Helena Jantz. And he was enough of a nerd that he even wrote down the date that they did it. And 9 months later, a daughter was born. They named her Francine, and she was the love of his life. And for a while, he acknowledged her, but not officially.
Because of the social...
Presumably because of circumstances, he couldn't do that. So for a while, this little family traveled around, because he was constantly traveling. And Helena Jantz was officially his housekeeper, and Francine was officially his niece. And she died when she was 5 years old of scarlet fever. And this whole period, from the beginning of this relationship through his child's death, corresponds, first of all, with a broadening of his philosophy, sort of a deepening of his philosophy. But also, after this period is when he writes The Passions of the Soul and hits on this notion of the importance of the emotions, philosophically, in terms of human understanding of reality.
So this is long after he's written The Method.
Right. So this suggests that, you know, maybe he had his own, he had done his own experiments on himself and was using this input as a way to try to comprehend and realize that this is another overlay on mind-body dualism.
And then many years later, it is discovered quite recently by somebody doing sleuth work as an historian that he didn't just throw over the housekeeper. Love story!
The story continues.
Descartes
in love, yes.
We can make a movie out of that.
It was long assumed that he had this affair with this woman, and then after the daughter was what held them together, and then after she died, that you don't hear about Helena Jantz anymore. A few years ago, a Dutch historian did some inspired archival digging. Descartes had lived for a time in the little village of Egmond by the sea in the Netherlands, and he did some digging nearby and discovered that a woman named Helena Jantz married a much younger man. She was in her 30s. He was, I think, 17 at the time. And lo and behold, you know, Helena Jantz was a fairly common name, but lo and behold, the man who put up the dowry for her was Descartes. So a Dutch philosopher named Theo Verbeek, who is now editing Descartes' correspondence, thinks that the possibility is that she was pregnant again and that Descartes was marrying her because he just couldn't, it was going to happen again. He couldn't deal with this all over again. In any event, she marries, lives on. He then goes to Sweden, to the ice and the cold, and dies. And it's as though, you know, he has reached this point of understanding, incorporating Hart into his theories, but he's not going to participate in it himself. He goes off and dies. She, however, has a life. She has a husband. They have a child. They becomes an innkeeper. The inn goes on through the decades. So this kind of experience, a much more human experience of the interaction between heart, mind, and body, is present and continues in the aftermath of Descartes' life, but he doesn't experience the full of it.
One of the fascinating things about this is that you point out is how central biology or protobiology mm-hmm. was in his thinking. Mm-hmm. You tend to think of this period in Newtonian terms, because yeah. Newton, for a lot of us, sort of defines what the Enlightenment was about. Mm-hmm. It's physics.
It's also English.
Mm-hmm. And recently, very recently, a friend of ours, Stuart Kaufman, has written a book about, he calls it Reinventing the Sacred, which is a whole other story, but it's not irrelevant to what we're talking about. He's arguing against reductionism, scientific mm-hmm. reductionism. He's a theoretical biologist, mm-hmm. and he is arguing that there are things we simply cannot know, predict, based on our science, and mm-hmm. that biology, and specifically evolution, is the principal evidence for that. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that connects to the kinds of things you're talking about, because part of the assumption that we tend to have about the Enlightenment and about reason is that because we know, understand, we think, or at least thought briefly, understand or almost understand the laws of nature, mm-hmm. that we understand how the world works, mm-hmm. and that everything can be reduced to quarks and gluons mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. other mm-hmm. exotic particles, Higgs bosons, assuming they exist. And Dr. Kaufman's argument is, I think, in some ways parallel to what you're talking about, which is there are things that we simply cannot know based on science.
Mm-hmm. And when sure. we come back with Russell Shorto, he'll tell us all those things that we cannot know based on science that maybe we can know based on biology, and we'll explore when we come back. Be with us. Russell Shorto has given us the honor to join us in conversation. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, Mr. Shorto. Mary Chase, Descartes' bones give us. And one of the many things in that the early part, as you say, the man who died mm-hmm. before you follow his bones through 300 years, more, a lot of years, the idea that he started thinking about our biology, mm-hmm. that it was his mm-hmm. body, the mm-hmm. embodiment part, and now all these hundreds of years later, that science is beginning maybe to be saying, yes, biology matters. Well, you have to have Darwin in there to help open up the mm-hmm, conversation mm-hmm, mm-hmm. over these centuries, and it gets us to the question Bill was putting forth about where does the unpredictability of the physical come in this.
Yeah. Well, one of the, to me, let me say this, when I hit on this notion of, you know, using Descartes' bones as a metaphor, hoping that there would be substance to it, of course, and you spend more time at it and you see one way in which it is indeed a metaphor, and then you encounter other sort of ironic aspects to it, one of which is Descartes is seen as the ultimate abstract thinker, whose name, I mean, Cartesian dualism, Cartesian coordinates, I mean, these are ultimate abstractions. But he himself, in his lifetime, was a medicine man. That's what he saw himself as. And he was going to employ these new methods of exploring the natural world on the body to unlock disease, and in particular on his own body, because he was a sickly child. He was told he was going to die. He then left home, went to school, and started to get better, maybe because he left home. Then he decided that this would be his life's work, to focus on the body and how to solve this riddle. And you see in that, I think, on the one hand, this very, you see the exuberance and the power that was felt in this new approach. But you also see the naive aspect of it. I mean, they believed that you could unlock the secrets of the body and cure disease, but they were a little naive and sort of, you know, I mean, he thought, you know, people would write to him and he'd say, give me a few years, and, you know, then I'll kind of flip the switch. And people thought, actually, he thought he would increase the human lifespan to centuries. So much so that after he died in Sweden, some people refused to believe it and wrote saying, well, wait a second, he was going to, you know, and people would write to him saying, have you, you know, I've got this problem, have you found the answer yet? And he would say no, but then he would give perfectly wise advice, which was typically get a lot of rest, think positively. I mean, it was good advice, but it wasn't the same. It wasn't quite, well, you know, what they were looking for.
In that moment, when you talk about Newton and when you talk about the milieu in which he was, mm-hmm. and I think milieu is the right mm-hmm. term, we had begun to think about the human body as a machine.
Mm-hmm.
Find what's broken.
Exactly, that's how they thought of it, as a machine. So the nice irony here is that because, particularly because his own flesh and bones were the root of his work, that's where he started. I mean, the idea of looking at Descartes' bones after death as well is just a very nice way to, because, and it's not accidental, because in that time, they looked at the body as a machine. They had this awareness of the body as sort of half of the equation of reality, the division of reality. And then how that plays out over the centuries in the development of science and development of medicine is that also becomes one half of the picture.
In the interest of getting past this very boring discussion and find something we can disagree about, we spent some time this weekend with friends who are Tibetan Buddhists.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at a book that Paul Ekman has written with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And Ekman's core work is on emotions. Mm-hmm. And his work with the Dalai Lama is about emotions. And it seems to me that there, in addition to the Trinity you lay out, mm-hmm. there's this other condition in the world that is this form of spirituality, not to say religion,
mm-hmm.
That is the Buddhist perspective, mm-hmm. that rigorously tries to unite reason with compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been at it for several hundred years. And it seems to me that as we talk about the challenges mm-hmm. that we face, that the opportunity we now have to reach out and access the various traditions that have been employed around about the world, that there's help available.
Mm-hmm.
There are insights available that have not historically been, but normally been
sure,
available.
Sure, and I'm afraid I'm not going to disagree with you there.
Well, damn.
But I would just say that I think a lot of people from different Christian denominations would say that they too try to unite reason and transcendence and find ways for those things to coexist, or would argue that in fact they do coexist. We just we are imperfect in our way of understanding it.
Yes, and the difference, I think, is the Buddhists do all the above without having a deity,
mm-hmm.
which is a distinguishing characteristic. Mm-hmm. You can make of that what mm-hmm. you will, but I only mention that one because I have hold these people in very high regard. But secondly, it's another way, even if you don't buy it, and this is not a proselytizing religion, the Buddhists mm-hmm. Are not. It provides what you've provided in your book, which is another way of examining the reality that we find ourselves amidst. It's mm-hmm. what you were saying earlier, three mm-hmm. biographies of Reagan, mm-hmm. and each one's going to look different. Mm-hmm. And again, we have those tools now available to us that simply hadn't been available before.
And do you think that those tools were not available before?
I think they were not routinely accessible to
the
us.
Tools specifically meaning?
I mean, access to the thinking,
to the
thinking that comes out of cultural traditions mm-hmm. that are alien to us.
Mm-hmm.
We have been ethnocentric,
mm-hmm.
Centric in lots of different ways, mm-hmm. species centric. Mm-hmm. We have friends who are bonobos,
mm-hmm.
Which presents another worldview.
Mm-hmm.
Franz de Waal would argue that morality and ethics comes out of what is necessary. for animals to live together, for community,
social animals
to live together. So there's this richness out there. And a lot of it, I think, was not known and was not knowable, because a lot of this is new information. Mm-hmm. The religious tradition is sort of cultural isolation, yeah. But there's also just an increase in the amount of knowledge. And I don't think this is just the progressivist fallacy.
But you're talking about spiritual knowledge rising above religious context and informing other...
I'm saying that is something that is available for us to consider, mm-hmm. in ways that we probably would not have considered it, mm-hmm. before.
That presupposes a society that is willing to consider such things.
Which I assume is part of your argument.
Well, and the problem is that I would postulate that a society that has gone through the centuries of Descartes' bones, the society that has experienced the Enlightenment, experienced the flaws of it, of thinking that reason alone can solve problems, is one that is on the verge of being able to access these traditions. Whereas a society that has not done that may not be there.
We'll be back in a moment to figure out where we are.
We'll vote.
We'll vote, not necessarily, but there are three of us, so we won't have an excluded. Right. It'll be with us when we return for a few more minutes with Russell Shorto. A few more minutes with Russell Shorto, who has done a wonderful thing with Descartes' bones. He is... given us a detective story, he's given us an anatomy lesson, he's given us a cultural exposition. Can I do exposition?
You can.
And a wonderful intellectual romp with Descartes' bones. You say at some point, fairly early on, that idiosyncrasy, being idiosyncratic, is dangerous business. Isn't that part of this story, is that if you're going to be out there on those edges, you better be ready for some real challenges?
What I say is that idiosyncrasy is sort of on the way out. Its importance is diminished in society. And I think it's important. It's an important thing to be able to open yourself up to exploring the nooks and crannies. And not, I mean, this gets back to what we were saying before about the toy model approach to understanding reality. I mean, if you've got your little pegs that you, which is how you know what history is, how you know what America is, how you know what your patriotism rests on, I mean, that's very flimsy.
Well, I look, as Bill was talking about, we're in an election process.
Yeah.
I'm baby boom, class one baby boom, and the Eisenhower years were very straightforward in do it, mm-hmm. this way, this is the model, mm-hmm. thou shalt not in any way deviate from it, and it sort of feels like there are people now in this process who want to go back to that. You know, it's got to be my way. It's got to be simple. Mm-hmm. You can't possibly get... But you can find that in any culture.
Oh, certainly. I don't think... I don't believe in denigrating Western culture on those grounds and saying it's inferior to others in that respect. I think that's probably something inherent in cultures and inherent in human nature.
Bill?
Bill disagrees.
No, I just...
You may.
No, I think the lesson in this, is, to me, is a lesson in humility.
Mm-hmm.
Descartes was clearly a very smart guy,
mm-hmm.
with a small brain capacity, apparently, that is by mass or volume or something.
But a big brain the other ways.
It's to me that the lesson in this is the importance of the learning, and I go back to the resources we now have available.
Mm-hmm.
I think of the Enlightenment as the simple day-to-day lesson in the Enlightenment for us is a commitment to evidence rather than opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of us would agree on that. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a common, yeah. ground where, yeah. we can live there. Right. Now, at some point, that we start coming apart when somebody is not willing to accept the evidence because of some prior perspective,
mm-hmm.
some what I view as a prejudice,
mm-hmm.
whether that is a fundamentalist Enlightenment perspective that says it has to be absolutely rational.
Right.
Which makes a hash out of Heisenberg,
mm-hmm.
Or whether it's a fundamentalist religious perspective that says that because my deity says it this way, then it has to be this way regardless of the evidence. And it seems that you know, part of the opportunity here is in the growth of the amount of evidence that we have access to, what by any reasonable standard would be considered valid evidence, that some things are the case and some things aren't the case. And to me, part of the joy of this is to understand the richness of these sources, that that by understanding them makes it easier to evaluate the quality of the evidence before us.
Yeah, but the challenge also is that with these great mountains of evidence, that puts a lot of effort necessary on the part of individuals sort through to you know, I mean, the internet is the example. I mean, how do you?
Yes.
This is what I say to my daughters all the time. You know, you got it from the internet. You know, this is how they're taught to do research.
How to trust your
sources? Where do you?
Is a test, and who do you trust?
Yeah,
and I mean, and in some ways, that's right at the heart of everything we're talking about here. And in one case, we have trusting a methodology.
Yep.
In the other, we have trusting an authority, and we've got lots of variations and combinations of that. And those inquiries, it seems to me, are very, very, very important.
You subtitled the book "A Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason." Isn't that right at the heart of what you both are talking about? Isn't that what this book is about, is to try to come to terms with that?
Yes, and saying that, in particular, beginning about 400 years ago, this became an issue. It became a philosophical issue, a political issue, an issue within individuals. And it has played out in different contexts in the centuries since then, and it plays out, and it's as alive today in our beings and in our world in 2008 as it was in Descartes' being and in the early 1600s.
If the modern is over, as some say, where does that leave us to go?
For a while, people thought we were in the postmodern, and then it sort of got pushed to the side a bit. So I think that's what we're wrestling with now. I mean, I live in Europe, I live in Amsterdam, and I think people are wrestling with it there in a very interesting, very pointed way, as they have seen themselves as the archetypal tolerant culture, and now they're feeling, the same people are feeling, that their tolerance has gotten them into this difficult societal quandary, and they're trying to figure out what is after the modern.
And the answer is?
Well, this is where we are. Next chapter.
The exploration is, the adventure continues.
Yeah, exactly.
We thank you. What a pleasant surprise Descartes' bones in all of their dust have brought us, and brought us you. Thank you again.
Thank you both very much.
We thank Russell Shorto for putting Trying Times in the World at Large to work in writing Descartes' Bones. It is fascinating. And we're delighted that he continued exploring the Enlightenment's powerful ideas here with us. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.